Newsmakers is brought to you by the Illinois American Water Company. I'm Gary Moore on today's program.
We can't forget that there's still 200 being held hostage, that some of the ones that were released went home to find out that their parents had both been murdered, that they are now orphans, that their siblings had been murdered or they were released without their siblings. In some cases, there were children released without their mothers, even though Hamas had said they would release their mothers, you know, the mothers and children together, they didn't. But I'm certainly happy to see them home, but I honestly feel like this is a deal that was made with the devil. Hamas is a terrorist organization, and I worry how this has elevated them.
Susan Katz with the Jewish Federation of Peoria talks about the Israel-Hamas conflict. A timekeeping note, this interview was done prior to the resumption of fighting between Israel and Hamas. As you may know, there had been a seven-day ceasefire in which Hamas was releasing hostages, Israel was releasing Palestinian prisoners, and there was a halt in the fighting. That has ended. My interview with Susan took place while the truce was still being observed and while hostages were being released. We started out our conversation by talking about Susan's trip to Washington, D.C., a pro-Israel rally where some 300,000 people demonstrated in the nation's capital. From what I understand, this was historic because it was probably the largest gathering of Jewish Americans in the nation's capital for any type of demonstration. Tell me just how you felt being there.
So I'm gonna make a small correction. It was actually the largest pro-Israel gathering because it was Jews and people of any faith who supported Israel. Because I saw a sign that said Christians for Israel. So I know that there were lots of people there. And they counted 300,000, which was huge. It was amazing. I've never been to a rally like that. I grew up in the 60s and 70s and never made my way to Washington for any of the marches. It was an incredible feeling after the months that we had to take the metro into the city and to see so many people on the streets with Israeli flags and clearly heading to the National Mall and getting inside the mall and seeing all those people who were all there to stand with Israel as we were. It was empowering, it was comforting, and it was powerful. It was amazing.
And you are also encouraged by the support that has been shown by President Biden, his administration?
I am encouraged by his support. I'm encouraged that that polls that have been done recently show that most Americans, the majority of Americans, support Biden and support Israel in this war. So that is very encouraging, despite what we may see on the news, that people, I think, understand on some level what is happening, and they are supportive. And we feel that we do have the support, and we voiced our support for Washington, and in fact, we chose to be at the mall at that particular time because Congress was in session, and my understanding is that there were 100 elected officials at that rally as well as the people that we saw speak.
And by most news accounts, President Biden played an integral role in helping to secure the release of some of the Israelis who were held hostage by Hamas. Talk to me about this hostage release and how that makes you feel. Are you encouraged by that or still with a raised eyebrow?
So I'm very encouraged to see the hostages go home, some of them. We can't forget that there's still 200 being held hostage, that some of the ones that were released went home to find out that their parents had both been murdered, that they are now orphans, that their siblings had been murdered or they were released without their siblings. In some cases, There were children released without their mothers, even though Hamas had said they would release their mothers, you know, the mothers and children together. They didn't. But I'm certainly happy to see them home. But I honestly feel like this is a deal that was made with the devil. Hamas is a terrorist organization, and I worry how this has elevated them. The Palestinians, from what I understand, are celebrating the release of the prisoners, which I understand. But these are people that attempted to kill Israelis and just weren't successful, some of them, and they've been released. And we're getting back children and babies and old people who did nothing but chose to live in the state of Israel.
So
it's kind of a mixed bag.
Yeah, I'll get to some questions related to the historical perspective in a moment, but talk to me about the truce, the ceasefire, in addition to the release of hostages.
I do know that Israel needs to complete the job that they started, which is to eliminate Hamas. I hope this time has also given people living in Gaza an opportunity to move south and to move out of harm's way. You know, should the war start up again, which I think it probably will. I think also during this time, things have come to light that the international community understands that Al-Shifa Hospital was used as a terror base, that it's given people a chance to see some of the evidence that has been collected. And it's good to have this time of calm. There's more humanitarian aid going into Gaza. And we'll see what happens next.
Yeah, you mentioned the hospital, and that's been a sore subject. What's your thought to those people who say the bombing of the hospital, the killing of Palestinian civilians, has Israel now being viewed in a different light from people who had been empathetic, but who are now saying now they're overstepping their mission?
So I think one of the things we have to remember when we hear about the casualty numbers coming out of Gaza, and I know there are a lot of casualties, but those numbers are being provided by Hamas. Hamas doesn't always tell the truth. So we don't really know what those numbers are because there hasn't been anybody who's been able to go in and corroborate those numbers, and the International Red Cross has not been allowed in. They've not been allowed in to even see the hostages. So we don't have any way of knowing what the real numbers are. The problem in fighting this kind of a war is that when you're fighting Hamas, you're fighting an enemy that hides itself among civilian populations. We know now that there were rifles and ammunition in the MRI room, that doctors had complained about Hamas operatives walking through the hospitals. I mean, they positioned themselves in the hospitals, and they positioned themselves in schools and children's bedrooms and zoos and amusement parks, and we've seen pictures of the tunnel coming up next to the Ferris wheel at the amusement park. So how does Israel fight an enemy that embeds itself in civilian population centers? They don't have a lot of options other than to go after Hamas where Hamas is. And that's where Hamas is, and that's done very deliberately on Hamas's part. So that's why Israel asked people to move south, and that's why, unfortunately, there have been civilian deaths in Gaza. I don't know how many, but yes, there have been, and nobody celebrates that. But Israel is fighting a war against Hamas, and they need to eradicate Hamas. Hamas doesn't have military bases, and they have a huge web of tunnels underneath the entire civilian population of Gaza, including the hospital, where they hide.
Yeah, it presents a conundrum. And now some people are saying, and this was a comment from the imam, the Palestinian cleric who I spoke with last week, who said one of the ramifications of this war is that Israel, by default, is creating more Hamas militants, or the potential for more Palestinian militants, because these civilians who are losing their family members in the rubble in Gaza are not going to forget that. and that these people are going to be seeking revenge. And so I asked him, ultimately, then what's the solution? Are we just going to be forever, generation after generation, witnessing conflict in this part of the world? So I ask you the same thing. Like I said, it's a conundrum. One thing begets the other. So where does it end?
Well, I hope that it ends with the people in Gaza having a better life. I mean, I know after World War II, we went in and helped rebuild Germany. If the Arab world can come together to rebuild Gaza and to not have it run by a terrorist organization, but by some kind of government that really, truly wants peace, that the people living in Gaza would have a much better life than they do now, and they would be safe, and the people in Israel would be safe. That's a lot to ask, but that's what I hope that would happen, because Hamas has made clear that they celebrated October 7th, and that they would do it again and again and again. So I don't think you can't have a neighbor like that. So hopefully at the end of the day, the challenge is going to be also that there have been generations of children growing up in Gaza raised on hate. So it is going to be very difficult to turn that around. But I don't think that means that we don't try. And the world...
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, I think there needs to be some international efforts at the end of this, when Hamas is eliminated, to make sure that... that there's some kind of government put in place that supports peace, that really, truly supports peace.
For the average person, and, you know, I'm trying to give voice to both sides of this conflict, mm-hmm. and just trying to educate people on the different perspectives. I can't verify what you say or what the Palestinian cleric says. You know, mm-hmm. he says... that some of the images of people being beheaded and that this was Israeli propaganda, that were it not for Israeli occupation, there would be no Hamas, going back some 70 years in terms of the West Bank and Gaza. And so I think, again, those of us who are trying to reconcile all of this and look for a peaceful solution, it's as clear as mud to us.
It is. I will say to you that for anybody to say that the evidence that was released on the massacres on October 7th is Israeli propaganda, it's not true, Gary. It's not. It's from the GoPros from the Hamas terrorists. There is video. There's phone recordings of them calling their families. There's testimonies from interrogations. They celebrated this. This wasn't made up. This was a horrendous massacre, and there was nothing made up. And they kidnapped, they kidnapped babies and children and old people. This isn't Israeli propaganda. These people are being held hostage. Mm-hmm. So all of these things that happened on October 7th, just in response to the imam's comments, happened. These are facts. There's a video, a 40-minute documentary that the Israeli ministry, and perhaps he would say this is propaganda, but they've taken it to journalists, to governments to show them, and it's from the GoPro cameras that the Hamas terrorists were wearing. Hamas is a terrorist organization. This isn't a war against the Palestinians. This is a war against Hamas.
Earlier, you mentioned the prisoners that were released by Israel, to which the imam says, yeah, there are thousands of people being held, and a lot of those people were arrested for infractions that were as small as throwing stones, juveniles, young people who have spent years in Israeli prisons and jails, but no one really knows that much about them. Again, you're getting into this conundrum chicken egg situation where the Palestinians say, were it not for 1948, Ralph Bunche, the establishment of this Jewish state in this land that was already occupied by some people, then you wouldn't have this ongoing conflict for the past 70 years. I'm still trying to figure out what is the ultimate solution. Is there a humanitarian solution? Because when I talk to you personally, I've known you for years, and I know you're humanitarian. Uh-huh. And when I talk to the imam, I get the feeling that he's a God-fearing, warm-blooded person. And I'm thinking, okay, well, is there some room for coexistence between just people?
So, I hope so. I know, I will tell you, in Israel, there's 1.5 million Arabs who live there, who vote, who are citizens, who have jobs, who go to school, who live side by side with Israeli Jews and Christians and Bedouins. So certainly in Israel, there's coexistence. There's no Jews in the Arab countries. I don't know if your listeners are aware of that. They were all expelled. So there were hundreds of thousands of Jews in Egypt, Syria, Iraq, Iran, Yemen, Jordan, Lebanon. They were all expelled after Israel was created as a state. I mean, history is complicated, you know. And then Israel was established. Israel was created by the UN. They were attacked by 6 Arab countries. Israel had accepted the partition plan. The Arab countries chose not to. They attacked Israel. They lost the war. And, you know, there's a lot of history. I'm not going to go into all the history. But Israel would like to live in peace with its neighbors. They have the Abraham Accords with a number of countries already. They'd like to live in peace with the Palestinians. I don't think Hamas does anybody any favors. In fact, at the rally that I was at, there were signs that said, free Gaza from Hamas.
Hmm.
We have signs that said that. I also want to share with you at the rally, we talked about the Palestinians, and we talked about getting rid of Hamas, that it would be in the Palestinians' best interest, and I think most Palestinians would agree if Hamas wasn't there. So that was the sign that I saw, and that's the feeling of free Gaza from Hamas, put a government in place that wants peace because Israel wants peace with its neighbors. And Israel has shown that time and time again. They have a peace agreement with Jordan, they have a peace agreement with Egypt, and they have the Abraham Accords. So they have certainly extended a hand for peace over the years, and they would like to live in peace with the Palestinian neighbors. It's kind of hard.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, I was going to say it's kind of hard when you got Hamas ruling the Gaza Strip, who had said October 7th was a victory, and they would do it again and again and again.
Yeah. What can you tell me about the Netanyahu government? Because I'm reading some reports that say that people in Israel are not too swift on the prime minister. And first of all, upset that they think that administration failed Israel on October 7th in terms of security. But beyond that, in terms of policies over the years that caused some grief among the Palestinians living there in terms of the encroachment and the building of more settlements in the West Bank.
Netanyahu was, okay, there were for weeks and weeks and weeks, there were protests in Israel because he wanted to institute some judicial reform that the majority of Israelis did not support. And what happened on October 7th was definitely a security failure. And he's the prime minister, so the buck stops at his desk. So I do think he's got a lot to answer for, and I don't know if he's going to be, if he's going to continue to be prime minister after this war. You know, if they'll have elections and if he'll win, I don't know.
But yeah, because some people were thinking. Because some people were thinking that because of the security failure on October 7th, that the military policy in terms of the relentless bombing of Gaza was, you know, kind of like an overreaction to compensate for the security failure, if you know what I mean.
I do. So one thing that I think a lot of people don't follow is over the last 17 years since Israel left Gaza and Hamas won that election and was put in place, there have been, and you're probably aware, that from time to time, Hamas starts launching rockets over Sderot and the envelope, and sometimes as far as Ashkelon and Tel Aviv, and there'll be an incursion for a week or two. They launch rockets, they try to kill people. Sometimes they do, sometimes, most of the time, the people go to their bomb shelters. But it really creates a pretty uneasy feeling among the people who live there that they're being attacked time and time again from Gaza. And that's happened, I can't tell you how many times over the last 17 years, but it has happened frequently. And sometimes it turns into a month-long incursion or a two-week incursion where Israel goes in and things quiet down. And the people in the south have been for years saying you need to do something because they're the ones that are attacked the most. And then they were flying, I know it sounds ridiculous, but they actually had balloons with fuses that would land in the farmers' fields and burn acres and acres and acres of farmers' fields in Israel, in the south of Israel. And they would lose their crops. And one time they came up under the tunnels and broke into a kibbutz, and I don't remember if they murdered anybody, but it was not good. So the people in the south for a long time have felt very threatened by Hamas. And Israel would respond, but not on this level, and then things would quiet down, and it would happen over and over again. And I think this massacre was beyond what anybody had ever seen, and it was enough, and we're going to take care of this, and we're not going to keep dealing with this every few years or every few months. So, you know, whether Netanyahu overreacted, I don't think he did. When you look at the scale of murder that happened on October 7th, I think he's just there. They're done with it, and Hamas needs to be gone, and they're doing what they need to do to finish the job. But yeah, they're sending in humanitarian aid. They're giving people safe passage to the south. They are, in the time of war, which war is awful, they're letting civilians know to move. And I don't remember, frankly, the Allies sending humanitarian aid into Germany in World War II. I mean, I think it's very unusual that you send humanitarian aid into a place that you are at war with. So maybe people can remember that they're not at war with all of the people living in Gaza. They're at war with Hamas, and they're trying to do what they can to provide for the civilians there while they're at this war. And it's complicated because, again, Hamas embeds themselves with the civilian populations.
Yeah, very complicated. Yeah. And we end this interview, rest assured that in my subsequent conversations, whether it be in the next week or two or month or days ahead, if I talk to people on the Palestinian side, they will have a whole different perspective. But I think one thing that everybody can agree on is that war is hell.
Yes.
And amen to anything that's going to bring an end to it. Susan Katz, I've been asking you a lot of questions. Anything that you wanted to impart that we didn't talk about?
No, I think that really Israel would like to see peace. I know the people of Gaza would like to see peace. I'm not sure about Hamas. But hopefully there's peace in their future and they can coexist and just all have good lives and be able to raise their children, go to work, go to school, and do what they want to do without being afraid in Gaza and Israel. Yeah. I think that's what we need to hope and pray for.
And I'll just add one additional note to that, and that is something that hopefully everyone agrees on as well, and that is that we here in this country don't need to extend the war by anti-Semitism and Islamophobia. It saddens me when I look up at the news and I see where a Jewish person has been killed or a Palestinian person has been killed because of somebody over here taking out their opinions on someone in a violent way.
I would absolutely, the Islamophobia and the anti-Semitism should have no place in our country.
Yeah. As Americans, we are the place where we can have a lively debate and disagree, but still try to find some common ground and at the very least be civil and coexist. So,
yeah. All right. Yeah, thank you for that.
All right. Susan, thank you. And we'll be talking to you at some point in time. Thanks always for making time for
us. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
All right.
Take care. Right. Bye-bye.
Now to my conversation with WPNV contributor and legal expert David Chaplin, who is a Peoria native living in Washington, D.C. So you're in D.C., a lot of stuff happening with regard to former President Donald Trump. And most recently, an appeals court ruling that the former president is not immune from prosecution in the civil case regarding the January 6th incident. Talk to me first about these gag orders. Why the ruling and then it gets suspended and then it seems like it's just been going back and forth with that.
Thanks for having me, first and foremost. It's always a pleasure to be on. I'll add, when it comes to Trump, we're really in uncharted territories as a country. He's really testing the boundaries and parameters of what a democracy with laws and rules that should be black and white, but we know they're not always black and white in terms of how they're equally distributed. But this is uncharted territory in regards to the level of power that someone can use. And gag orders, in this case, part of this unprecedented nature of the facts themselves, where you have both, in this case, you had a gag order on the parties. The expanded gag order included now the attorneys, because Trump's attorney is also making remarks about, you know, law clerk's personal life, and now her family being attacked personally, as well as the judge. And so when you have those things happen in the public purview, the court has to do something to create more guardrails. And that's really the challenge of the power that he has, and the uptick in threats and anti-Semitic comments made toward the law clerk and the judge in this case, in order to kind of sway public opinion as a front runner for the Republican presidential nomination, has, you know, the pulpit of a level that we've never seen, but also under heavy indictment.
And the appeals court has ruled that Trump is not immune from prosecution in the January 6th case. This is an important ruling, I think, for all citizens to kind of sit up and take notice of. And I think Judge Chutkan mentioned something about Trump is not a king. You want to expound on that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the judge really tried to enforce the idea, the notion, which should be a principle, and that the court cannot conclude that the Constitution cloaks former presidents with absolute immunity, right, from any federal crimes they committed while in office. I mean, at the end of the day, we're talking about someone who allegedly committed crimes while in office, regardless of their stature or status, that should be held to account. That shouldn't be questioned, right? And our Constitution shouldn't be designed to cloak or prevent those people from being held accountable.
Justice Sandra Day O'Connor passed away. She was formerly on the Supreme Court. And she was viewed as a moderate, although she was appointed by Republican President Reagan. She was a moderate who upheld Roe v. Wade, upheld affirmative action, you know, basically saying that you want to keep precedents set. This current court weakened affirmative action and reversed Roe v. Wade. And I want to say is now considering a case where they're looking at what they call the bureaucratic state, what Republicans call the bureaucratic state, where governmental entities too much power and can't mete out discipline or against employees and whatnot. Is Sandra Day O'Connor's death a nail in the coffin of a moderate court?
I mean, these things ebb and flow, right? And Trump did when we back up, we zoom out, politics, I think, in this country, there's been a death of moderate voices, you know, on both sides, Republican and Democrat, but particularly in the Republican Party, where moderate voices are viewed as liberal, right, which is kind of a new tenor that, you know, Republicans are using vis-a-vis the Trump era, vis-a-vis the Tea Party movement under Obama that kind of initiated some of this rhetoric. And I think her death is symbolic to a degree of at that level, right? And we're seeing the levels of abuse of power that Supreme Court of Justice are currently under investigation for, right? And we see how damaging it can be when those powers are unchecked. And so in her regard, first female on the Supreme Court, I think she did, you know, the best she could at the time that she was appointed, in the time of our country, to kind of keep the guardrails of what civil discourse should look like and what civil laws should read.
All right, David Chaplin, always a pleasure to talk to you. Wish we could have more time to talk about some other issues. And hey, you take care of yourself in the nation's capital, Washington, D.C.
Blessings to you and all the people back home. Appreciate y'all.
Newsmakers is brought to you by the Illinois American Water Company for WPNV. WPNV, we're Peoria's neighborhood voice.